Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to the third talk of the practice period series. You'll be happy to know we're leaving loneliness behind. Moving on. But I'd like to begin with the end of last week's talk, the poem by Hafiz. Just to kind of connect back to that, and then we'll carry on. As you may remember, it goes, don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you, as few human or even divine ingredients can. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need of God absolutely clear. Now, this poem of Hafiz urges us to stay with our loneliness instead of quickly shedding it. I think it urges us to make our loneliness into a Dharma gate. Sometimes through loneliness, once we kind of pass through loneliness, we enter into solitude. And solitude, when I looked it up on the internet, online, a dictionary said that solitude comes from the Latin word solus, which means alone. But it is an aloneness that is free or mostly free from loneliness. It is, I think, an aloneness in which we can become really intimate with ourselves. I think it's an aloneness where we can really realize our true home. As we say in the incense chant, may awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. Some people love solitude, love being by themselves, and others fear it. Solitude in our culture can be a punishment, right? Like time out for children. I don't know if you ever, your parents ever told you, okay, time out, go to your room. My parents never called it time out. They just said, go to your room. I never knew when the door would open and I could then leave again. Or, of course, when prisoners go into solitary confinement. I recently listened to a program on the CBC on Ideas, I think it was, about the severe suffering that prisoners experience when in solitary confinement, and the long-lasting physical and emotional effects that come from enforced solitude. I think true solitude, kind of being alone but not lonely, is relatively rare in our modern life. Rare because we fear solitude, a lot of us fear solitude, and that it will turn somehow into loneliness. And I think it's also rare because kind of the new social expectations make it almost impossible to be truly alone, right? We're expected to be in contact with people. And I see this really strongly amongst my students. Most of the young students that I teach these days seem to have no desire at all for solitude when I've talked to them about it, or when it comes up when I'm discussing religious practices. And they have very little understanding why solitude is worth having. In the classroom, I constantly battle with them to get them to set aside their computers, to close their laptops, right? As they're watching a movie or listening to me, I say, you have to close your laptop. Put their cell phones down. Yeah, I see them like this, and they think I don't know what they're doing, right? As they're texting one another. And even if I'm successful, you know, I finally get them to all turn off their cell phones, put them away, laptops are closed, they are watching the video I'm showing or listening to the lecture. As soon as we have a break or the class is over, most of them immediately are whipping out their smartphones and checking the latest Twitter or their Facebook updates or their emails. I believe their use of technology is a constant effort to stave off the possibility of solitude or loneliness. And many of them seem shocked, absolutely shocked, when I tell them I don't check my school email on weekends. For many, and not just students, but for many of us, there is a constant need to be in the imaginative presence of others. The imaginative presence of others. Not to be cut off from social groups, even for a short time. My young students are surrounded by a cocoon of 100 or more friends on Facebook. I actually asked how many people had 100 friends, and it was amazing how many people put up their hands. 100 friends. How could you have 100 friends? Anyway, so 100 friends on Facebook, various blogs and Twitter streams that they're following constantly. And there's this constant influx, of course, of messages and sending off of various text messages. So perhaps most of this younger generation fear loneliness or isolation from a group. But I wonder if the technology that now keeps us ever in touch and the possibility of loneliness or isolation at bay really feeds the fear of possible loneliness and even more prevents them from tasting solitude at all. And I'll talk a little bit more what I mean by solitude in just a moment. And of course, it's not just young students. Many would be lost without their, what's the term, crackberries? Their crackberries and their smartphones. Now, I suppose I'm a bit of a curmudgeon, maybe even a bit of a Luddite, because I'm a bit of a curmudgeon who works with young people teaching at the university, and I do point fingers. But I also acknowledge that when I was young, solitude was not something that I really sought out or valued in my own youth, right? I just didn't kind of grasp it. But as I remember it, it wasn't so much loneliness but boredom that kind of drove me away from solitude. And I think that was true of many of my friends as well, right? It wasn't being lonely, it was like bored. Don't want to be bored. Boredom. The interesting thing about boredom is that you can be bored together with somebody else. Right? What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? I don't know. I'm bored. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? So we were often bored, but I don't remember being lonely that much. Boredom was the negative feeling of having nothing to do, just as loneliness is the negative feeling of being alone, right? Before the destruction of internet, of course, in my generation, we had TV. We had TV to kind of relieve boredom to a greater or lesser extent. But now, you know, having nothing to do seems so precious to me. I have nothing to do. Wow. How wonderful to be idle. How wonderful to be idle. Walt Whitman wrote that idleness is really a positive experience of boredom. He wrote this, in his own words, he says, "Idleness is the poet's passive yet passionate receptivity to the world." Isn't that great? Passionate receptivity to the world. I remember a conversation I had about students with Kathy Fisher, who is Norman's wife. Does everyone know Norman? Like Zoketsu Norman, who's he's still a guiding teacher of Mountain Rain, long time Zen practitioner and ordained, and gave transmission to Kate and I. I mean, most people, I think, know Norman. Anyway, so we were down there and talking with Norman's wife in San Francisco. And did I say she's an elementary school teacher? Okay. Middle school teacher, yeah, middle school teacher. And she said one day a student complained to her about the topic that they were studying. And I don't remember what it was. I think it was something to do with nature, because she's very much a teacher of science. I think sciences, nature sciences. Anyway, the student complained, "The topic is boring." And Kathy responded, "It's not boring. You're boring." And she said, "You're making yourself bored. You're making yourself bored. You're boring," like, you know, making it into a verb, right? "You're making yourself bored." And I thought, this is pretty insightful. This is what we do, right? We make ourselves bored. Anyway, I thought it was pretty insightful, and I hope her student came to understand his own role in kind of passively waiting for stimulation. That's, you know, when's the next hit coming? And maybe someday he'll come across Whitman's idleness as the passive yet passionate receptivity to the world, and remember his conversation with his middle school teacher. I would like to suggest that solitude is not quite the same as simply being alone. Because there's times in our lives when we want to be alone, away from the responsibilities and obligations of relationship or of work or of the to-do list. We just want to be alone. To have some time for ourselves, right? Just some time alone. And physically, we may be alone. But when we have that time alone, do we watch TV? Do we turn on the radio, listen to music? Do we pick up a novel to read? Do we engage in some kind of other activity? There is a seductive freedom to being alone, because then we can watch what we want, listen to what we want, read what we want. If it's not pleasing, we change. We change the channel, we pick up something else to read. And I would like to call this shallow solitude. Shallow solitude. An aloneness that is tempered by distraction. And I don't mean this in a negative way. I don't mean that this is something we shouldn't be doing. Shallow solitude, maybe I need to think of a different word for it, is really helpful and very nourishing, and I certainly enjoy it. Find it very helpful for myself. We need this time. We need this time for ourselves. And yet, we're not really by ourselves. Deep solitude, another kind of phrase I would just like to suggest, is time alone and when we're not engaged in a distracting activity. We physically place ourselves alone in a quiet place and enter into the spaciousness of the present by doing nothing, by doing very little, by being idle in Whitman's sense of the word. The demanding voices of the past, demanding voices worried about the future, quieten, and we begin to become intimate with ourself. Sitting alone in a room, looking out the window with a cup of tea, walking aimlessly along a path in the woods or somewhere in nature on your own. These are all experiences of solitude, I think, that we can have in our daily life. Solitary, quiet, and in some sense, still, then we open. We open to introspection. We open to seeing our nature. We open to seeing our depths. And entering again and again into this kind of solitude, we come to know more of who we are. Solitude can be frightening. And as we know, it can be an escape as well. If we use it to avoid a painful relationship or a painful situation. And really, solitude really isn't easy. And it requires, I think, strong effort to wade through the streams of loneliness and boredom that may come up first. The habits of distraction are strong. Our modern culture stresses the need and provides, of course, a stimulation for us so easily. Just push a button, plug in the buds, and away you go. I know I find it very hard to not check my email when I'm alone or get involved in some project on the to-do list. I've been trained that way, and I imagine most of us have. To do nothing is not a bad thing, despite our proverbs about the devil in idle hands. It may even lead to insight or liberation. I remember a boyhood friend I hung out with for a while, and his family belonged to a Christian church that taught that Sunday was a day of rest. And when I visited him on Sundays, we couldn't play. That was considered not rest. We couldn't play. We couldn't watch TV or engage in our usual kind of roughhousing around that we did. We used to kind of wrestle and punch each other in the shoulder and do those boy things. We could talk inside, or we could walk. And I thought, this is pretty weird. And yet, when I look back, those quiet Sundays really matured our friendship beyond our years. And I first became conscious of the tenderness of friendship. I first became conscious of the possible tendership of a friendship. So I asked myself, why do we need solitude, especially the deep solitude, as I was trying to describe earlier? Why do we need this in our life? And I think it's really important for us to consider this, in part so we can make a conscious decision to make or not make a space for solitude. Because solitude often doesn't just happen. So, first, solitude gives us time and space for introspection, a chance to know in a deep way who and what we are. I think to become intimate with ourselves. And I'm not referring to meditation. I'm not referring to meditation here, more like a kind of contemplation, a considering, a closer look at our own life. And I think this is important because with this evaluation of our inner life, then we can set our course. How do I want to live? What can I give to the world? What is most important in these remaining years? The Buddhist tradition recommends contemplation to help us set our direction, help us set our compass. And some of these contemplations have been formalized in the Buddhist tradition. One of the most famous of these, you probably have been somewhat familiar with, is the five reflections or the five remembrances. And one version of them kind of goes like this. I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. Not the most cheerful of remembrances and reflections, but very powerful.
One more line.
I left that line out. My deeds are the ground upon which I stand.
My deeds are my only possession.
My deeds are my only possession. Yeah, they are the ground upon which I stand. So in deep solitude, that kind of quietness that we're not distracting ourselves, we come to clearly know our fears, our desires. And just as importantly, we come to know the shy and quiet aspects of our personality. The parts of us that can't be seen without silence and stillness. Solitude also confirms or reaffirms our connection to nature. Thoreau wrote an essay called Solitude that appears in his famous book on Walden's Pond. And near the beginning of the essay, he wrote of being lonely, because he spends this, I think it's a year, more or less by himself on Walden Pond. So he wrote of being lonely, but then he then wrote this immediately after that. He said, in the midst of a gentle rain, while these thoughts prevailed, these thoughts of loneliness, I was suddenly sensible of such sweet and beneficent society in nature, in the very pattering of the drops, and in every sound and sight around my house, an infinite and unaccountable friendliness, all at once, like an atmosphere, sustained me. As made the fancied advantages of human neighborhood insufficient. And I have never thought of them since. Every little pine needle expanded and swelled with sympathy and befriended me. I was so distinctly made aware of the presence of something kindred to me, even in the scenes which we are accustomed to call wild and dreary, and also that the nearest of blood to me and humanness was not a person or a villager, that I thought no place could ever be strange to me again. They wrote long sentences in those days. Boy. So perhaps you too, you know, can relate to Thoreau's experience of the elements of the earth as one's true companions. Sometimes on my drive to teaching at the SFU at Surrey campus, I stop at a park called Tynehead Park, a wild riparian area, and I walk there. Not for long, maybe it's about 15 minutes or so. And walking those paths, you know, especially now in autumn, I feel a deep connectedness with life all around me. The trees, the brush, the tree, the birds are very close. And I wonder if the runners, those people jogging with earbuds, and the chattering pairs of friends walking by have the same sense of intimacy or not. And I suspect they don't. A period of solitude can also help us face our inner obstacles, the dark and painful places that we keep turning away from. We turn away from them because we're too busy. The busyness of our lives kind of distracts us. I think we've all had the experience of, in times of grief, you know, or the death of a loved one, for example, we may simply want to retreat from the everyday world and become alone with our grief. At that time, solitude can allow us to embrace our grief, although we need to take care that the solitude then doesn't become just an escape, preventing us from making contact with others. However, if we are mindful and aware, solitude becomes a crucible for healing. Tenzin Palmo, a British woman who ordained as a Tibetan nun and spent 12 years living in a cave in northern India, mostly in complete solitude, responded to the suggestion that solitude was an evasion of the difficulties of ordinary life by writing this. She said, "When you have a problem, you can turn on the television, phone a friend, go out for coffee. In a cave, however, you have no one to turn to but yourself. When problems arise and things get tough, you have no choice but to go through with them and come out the other side. In a cave, you face your own nature in the raw, and you have to find a way of working with it and dealing with it." Now, while I don't think anyone here is really up for spending 12 years in a cave in northern India, I think we can consider how a period of solitude, a kind of solitude without distraction or with very little distraction, can help us be with and work with the various difficulties that arise within our life. So lots of ways we can use solitude. But solitude isn't an end in itself. Often, you know, at the end of a week-long meditation retreat, I find myself wishing the retreat would continue. After 6 or 7 days, the mind is clearer. This kind of storm of emotions that may have arose at the beginning of the retreat is now calm. And the worries and anxieties of my life have settled somewhere into the far background. And I kind of rest in a sense of equanimity. If only the retreat could go on and on. That's kind of the sense I have. Thomas Merton, the great Christian thinker and contemplative monk, warned against the lure of simply withdrawing from the world and living in aloneness or solitude. Over the summer, I read his last book that was published after he died, called The Inner Experience, Notes on Contemplation. And he wrote this, solitude is necessary for spiritual freedom. But once that freedom is acquired, it demands to be put to work in the service of love, a love that cannot be manipulated by flattery or base motives. Mere withdrawal without the return to the freedom, without return to freedom in the action, would lead to a static and death-like inertia of the spirit. There would be no light. Withdrawal and solitude, as Merton makes clear, are two different things. Solitude is working with our life so that we can give back to the world. Solitude can be an expression of our bodhisattva vow to attain complete awakening for the sake of all sentient beings. And we chant the bodhisattva vows fairly frequently here. And finally, the last thing I want to say about solitude today is it also gives us space for creativity to arise. The American psychologist and writer Rollo May said, in order to be open to creativity, one must have the capacity for constructive use of solitude. One must overcome the fear of being alone. So solitude contains and nurtures the inner world, in part because we're isolated from the influence of the other, isolated from the influence of something from outside. And so we can better find our own voice, our own creativity. And finally, solitude also helps us to appreciate the small things that get lost in kind of the roar of our daily life. And we can give those voice too. Next week, I'll talk more about solitude in our Buddhist practice and the kind of Buddhist view of solitude. But I thought I'd like to end with a short quote by Rilke. He wrote in a letter to a friend, I think this friend was a poet, but Rilke wrote this. He said, I hold this to be the highest task for a bond between two people, that each protects the solitude of the other. That each protects the solitude of the other.
May
our intention equally extend to every. So the questions are, how do I respond to solitude in my life now? What blocks it? How can I initiate solitude and stay with it? And a second possibility may be a story of a strong experience of solitude that you have had in your own life.